Sophocles.
What is it, Marty? I'm swamped. I got no time to talk to my agent.
We gotta talk about this Oedipus play.
What's wrong with it? It's a great play.
Have you seen the rotten grape leaf score? It's 16%.
Bunch of morons.
Maybe, could we talk about some changes?
Like what?
Am I getting this right that he kind of, well, he does his mother? Because they don't like that.
That's the whole point.
Okay, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but he also kills his father.
Spoiler.
Can we give the audiences something? Audiences like it if the couple gets together at the end.
Him and his mother?
Right. Point taken. That's a no-go. Come on, Sophie, give me something.
I did have one idea for a rewrite.
Yeah?
After he does all this stuff, he turns his gaze to Olympus and he says to the gods, "Look what you made me do. Look what you made me do."
I love it. Let's go with that. Meanwhile, on the nose today, the panel will go after an 86% bruised banana rating. And now the old Colin can't come to the phone right now, so here's the new Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, the old Colin's dead, unfortunately. All right, so I swear, I promise, before I even introduce the panel, I promise we're really not going to talk about Taylor Swift, not for real, again, after having talked about her 2 weeks ago. However, we are going to have to stray into Taylor Swift-infested waters, one might say. But first of all, let me tell you who's here. That's the most exciting part, of course. Carolyn Payne, actress, comedian, dancer, many other things, founder, director, choreographer of Kinetic Dance. Irene Papoulis, teaches writing at Trinity College. Kate Russian, teaching artist for the Connecticut Office of the Arts and a Pushcart Prize nominated poet. So in the second segment today, we'll do that first, we're going to talk about a movie that we all saw. I probably loved it more than everybody else did, but that's good because we'll have some areas of friction. It's called Wind River. It is sort of a noir movie with snow, with lots of snow. It takes place on an Indian reservation. It's both a thriller and an examination of social problems among Native Americans and a bunch of other things as well. So we'll come to that. In the first segment, we're going to combine two ideas. One of them is a much-debated essay by critic Mark Harris, writing in New York Magazine, about it's about a bunch of different things, but it's the headline, the provocative tweet-engendering headline is Taylor Swift's Look What You Made Me Do is the first pure piece of Trump-era pop art. A little bit later, we're also going to talk about the role that Rotten Tomatoes and ratings like it are now playing in the success or failure of movies, that they may be pinned much more tightly to movies than they ever have been before. But let's begin with this this essay. It's not really an essay about Taylor Swift. I think what it really is, well, for example, he says, when we talk about pop culture in the age of Trump, we tend to mean art of the self-styled resistance. But what about the stuff that history will record as epitomizing our time rather than raising a fist against it? The phrase Reagan-era culture doesn't call to mind David Lynch's Blue Velvet or Larry Kramer's The Normal Heart. It's dynasties, slavering fetishization of wealth, power, and conspicuous consumption, or the lubed militarism of Top Gun. Then maybe we can just stop there. And he's got a whole bunch of different examples of what he feels as though is culture that's emblematic of this moment and that is feeding off the moment and being fed off of by the moment. He actually starts out with the Mayweather-McGregor fight before winding his way towards, among other things, Taylor Swift. But so, Irene Papoulis, I'm going to start off with you. What about that idea that in any given moment there is culture that's produced kind of on the spot that either plugs into a fairly dark energy of the moment or is a canvas onto which the dark energy of the moment paints? Does any of that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Or if I said it more sensibly, would it make sense to you?
Yeah, so that is sort of a prelude to talking about the actual content of what Look What You Made Me Do, which I think is interesting. Yeah, first of all, I think it is true that we think of dynasty when we think of the 80s. Mm. We don't think of Blue Velvet for the most part. And, you know, was that because dynasty kind of I guess it is because dynasty epitomized the greed. So is it, you know, and it's sort of like, is it the fact that that thing is elevated at the time, or is it that the person who created that thing is responding to the culture, you know, is kind of, I don't know, to me an interesting question. But it does seem to I kind of get his point, you know, that there is. But why is it that the most sort of vulgar, quote unquote, elements of an era are the ones that define it. You know, he doesn't really get into why that would be. Does
well,
he?
It could depend on the era, too. I mean, an era that's sort of heavily invested in materialism or conflict. I mean, Kate, that then raises this next question. Is it reasonable to point to, say, the McGregor-Mayweather fight or to a Taylor Swift song and say, yeah, somehow or other, this either sums up the moment we're in right now or is almost a sort of, you know, fecal-like byproduct of the moment that we're in right now?
Well, you know, I'll speak about the Mayweather-McGregor fight because I saw it, and it was a spectacle that involved millions and millions of dollars, no matter who won or who lost. And it took place between the fight took place between a champion, undefeated boxer, and a mixed martial arts guy.
Did you see it because you wanted to, or because somehow you were forced to?
I just happened to be in that bar. That evening, and
as opposed to strapped to a chair with their eyelids taped open,
and you know, there are all these debates about boxing: is it the sweet science or is it just brutal blood sport? But then you put together a very skilled boxer with a mixed martial arts guy who just basically knocks everything out of everybody he touches. There's really no competition because, of course, Mayweather won. And so what was this all about? It was just about the spectacle and the money, period.
So this fight was like the Shark Week Phelps versus White Shark race. It was kind of the same
thing. Beautiful analogy and only one that only you could have come up with. So, Carolyn, what I think is just to build on what Kate's saying here is if in fact these things are all of a piece, and I would be happy to throw Phelps versus Shark into that tank, is that these things are illusions, right? That if they're products of the Trump era, they're products, they're illusions. That there was no, as Kate is saying, no real serious contest between McGregor and Mayweather, except obviously the symbolic one between a white guy and a black guy, and each one of them walking around with some pretty weird issues. Any more than Apprentice was really a serious evaluation of managerial talent, any more than the beefs that are the subtext of Look What You Made Me Do with Kanye West and Katy Perry and God knows who else and Taylor Swift. Are I think anything other than kabuki that allows everybody to march off to the bank laughing. I don't know. I mean, you said that you thought the Taylor Swift thing, which we're about to play in just a second, but you can talk first so it won't put you in a horrible mood, was smacking people in the face with symbolism.
Yeah. So I do think that the Trump era, if we're going to look at it from a cultural standpoint, I think for me and for what it's done for me as somebody like creating art and it has changed like the course of what I'm interested in, what I think that this is a peak time for comedy that is looking to make itself relevant and a response to things. And I think that we also not just comedy that is responding to this, but comedy that is so or entertainment that is giving us something to do, not like, you know, that is not sitting around and feeling stressed and feeling overwhelmed or feeling. I think that we are looking for things to occupy our mind. And I think that having things like, you know, Michael Phelps race a great white, or I guess this fight, which I didn't watch, although my neighbor did try to knock on my door and get me to come watch it. But I had no idea what they were talking about at
not
the time.
Ben, I hope.
But I think that there is, I think that that is what, where we are at culturally. I think that that is what we're going to look back on as this era, as of things that are these kind of great distractions.
Well, are they just distractions, Kate, or are they things that, in fact, I think they're more than distractions. I think there are ways that kind of scratch at the same
weird boil. Well, that's what I'm saying.
Like,
they are things that get us thinking and but are helping
us cope.
They
feel real.
Yeah.
I guess what I don't see is how this era is different from previous eras of American culture that were all about the brand, all about money, all about accumulation of wealth, all about distracting us from whatever is right in front of our face at the time during any generation.
So do you see the fight as an emblem of something that's not – it's a that's particularly now, or you don't see it as particularly
well,
now?
I don't see how it's different from spectacles of the 50s, 60s, 70s, or 80s, or
and
90s.
I think it's a great point that you're making. And Don King decades ago said – white guy against black guy, your box office just automatically goes up. I mean, control for all other variables. That's not a phrase Don used. But, you know, your box office just goes up. And that's true in the 80s, 90s, you know. I mean, it,
but at least they followed the rules.
At least they were both boxers.
They had two boxers.
So,
yeah,
so Irene, let's now hear Exhibit A in our array of evidence here. This is the aforementioned earworm.
Don't like your little games. Don't like your tilted stage. The role you made me play of the fool. No, I don't like you. I don't like your perfect crime. How you laugh when you lie. You said the gun was mine. Isn't cool. No, I don't like you. Check it once, then I check it twice. Oh, look what you made me do. Look what you made me do. Look what you just made me do.
I don't know why I felt the need to play that. You can't get away from the damn song anyway.
That was like a long, we played a good amount.
If you haven't heard it, I'd like to know where you're living and how you're hiding from it. So Harris writes, as we watch Swift's video, and yes, I get it, it's not a crime against art, just a clever, irritating, hyper-self-aware pop earworm calculated to prove that she can not only take a joke, but she will own and copyright said joke. We should probably pause to remember that none of this fame-enthralled solipsism emerged from a vacuum. It's the Big Bang from which Trump, the self-selling celeb, was spawned, and his presidency didn't invent this grim and cynical strain of pop culture. It's just given it a good home. And then none of this exists without our complicity. We may smirk at it, but it smirks right back. And there's a way, Irene, in which this song immediately became this sort of all-purpose trope, right? I mean, it got applied to Trump's DACA approach.
Exactly. Trump's everything, which is it's the opposite of personal responsibility. You know, look what you made me do. It's your fault. Whatever I did, it's your fault because I have no responsibility. I'm just reacting. And so to me, it's about the isolation that we have from our own inner selves, you know, that he has from his own inner self, and that in a way the culture is sort of moving more and more toward, seems to me, of just sort of like denying our inner, you know, our deepest sort of emotional realities and inner life in the name of just external appearances and spectacles. And so instead of saying, like, why did I do that? It's like, you made me do it. End of discussion. It's your fault.
Yeah, I mean, Kate, I feel like the thing does turn into an anthem for the moment. Not only is it musically a bad thing, but it might be philosophically a bad thing.
Well, you know, before I came in today, I was listening to Dave Zirin talking about the incident that happened right after the Mayweather-McGregor fight where Michael Bennett was profiled and wrestled to the ground. And according to him, he was threatened by the police with a gun. And when I think about, well, what are we being distracted from by these spectacles, it's that sort of thing we're being distracted from, where people are being profiled, people are being abused.
So that's like on a cultural level, you know, like we're not examining what we're really doing, like our inner self as a culture, not only as individuals.
So.
Right.
I think so.
And it's all wrapped up for a bow right there. So you have this kind of racialized martial arts spectacle, and Michael Bennett's attending it in Vegas. There's this moment. Michael Bennett is a very talented defensive player for the Seattle Seahawks.
Oh, thank you, because I was like, who's Michael Bennett?
Okay, Michael Bennett, really big guy. And suddenly people think they hear shots fired. They start running away from the, where they think the shots are fired. Michael Bennett is one of the guys running away, but he's a big black guy running away. The cops grab him, throw him to the ground, and according to him, really do kind of verbally abuse him and also physically abuse him. And so you have it kind of all there, right? I mean, you've got the spectacle and the reality within about, you know, 500 yards of each other. So just as we wrap this up, because we do have to switch topics. So Carolyn, the other part of this is that notion that Harris brings up that, you know, when you start to have this culture, a musical culture mainly, that is increasingly absorbed with the artist's persona, almost to the exclusion of all else. You know, that Taylor Swift, whether you like it or not, her oeuvre is increasingly, and Katy Perry's oeuvre and Kanye's oeuvre and whoever else you want to toss in there, it's being kind of eaten up by its own interest in itself and these various beefs, most of which seem theatrical rather than real, that it seems unlikely that you're going to produce anything interesting or exciting under these circumstances, no matter how talented you are. What's your
reaction? Well, that's how I feel about it. I see Irene's perspective of this song, the phrasing of "look what you made me do" being some sort of statement for where we're at right now, but I can't separate this song from Taylor Swift. I know we don't want to talk about Taylor Swift, but like this song is her. This is a woman expressing her own, you know, kind of like, I'm moving on. I'm better than this now. I'm in a tub with diamonds. Like, I just can't take away her and her, the whole, like, this whole melodrama she has created around her persona and her interactions with other celebrities. And it just, it all feels like that's overplayed to me. And then in this video, as I had said in the email, that I feel that it was slapped through with all this symbolism that we were supposed to go through. There were all these blogs that were like breaking down all the symbols in Taylor Swift's video. I mean, it was like they were trying to analyze it like it was a great piece of literature in their college lit class. Like, that was, to me, absurd, because it is not some great. I think there have been great. There are great pieces of music that speak to where we're at in a moment. And I just don't feel like this deserves that.
Although it may get this moment better than the great pieces of music, too. Sometimes bad art gets the moment better than great art. We do have to move on here. So one thing that we know is about the movie business, which we're also going to be talking about a little bit in the second segment. It's so bad that America's three biggest theater chains have lost roughly $4 billion in market value since May. The reason for that is ticket sales are down. The summer movies have underperformed after a pretty languid series of movies leading up to the summer. Something is really wrong. Everybody's looking for somebody to blame. This business is really in a lot of trouble. I was at one of the multiplexes last night to watch when there were like maybe 40 people in the entire multiplex if you added up all the theaters. So that would worry me. So the argument that's being used, since you made a noise, Irene, I'm going to start with you. The argument that one of the arguments that is being used is that more and more Rotten Tomatoes scores are being attached to people's first engagement with these movies, whether they're seeing them on Google or buying tickets on Fandango. And it's just hard to get yourself, no matter how much you like the Transformers, to buy a ticket to a movie that has a 16% Rotten Tomatoes rating. That this, first of all, commodification and dataization of critical assessment is weird, and then has become so widespread that it's a real problem for movies.
I mean, I think that's a big jump, and it's an interesting jump, because I think part of why people don't, there's so many reasons why not enough people are going to movies, and I think it's horrible. I hate it when there's only 10 people in the room with me when I'm watching it. But to jump to that, I mean, it can't be because of Rotten Tomatoes, you know, because then that would mean that if something got a really high rating, the theaters would be full, but they aren't. Or are they? I don't know.
This fascinates me because I hate going to the movies. I have seen more movies thanks to doing this show than I probably ever would have. And I have
How could you hate going to the movies?
I have a list. I have a whole list of things. Like, one is, I hate if you have to go to the bathroom, you can't like pause it, so you have no control. So you always inevitably miss something important. It's expensive, and it's probably expensive because I go and binge on like popcorn, and then you know it's salty, so you need a sweet thing on the side, and then you get a drink or whatever.
Which makes you go to the bathroom.
So it's all this, and then also like, what happens if you go to see a movie and it's just awful, and now you've paid all this money and you have your popcorn, and like you're probably there with a friend who likes it, and now you're trapped. I don't know. I get a lot of anxiety going to the movie, so maybe it's people like me.
That is sort of a millennial perspective, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, do you look at Rotten Tomatoes before you go see a movie?
I mean, yes and
she
no.
She only goes to first run movies because we make her go.
Yeah.
So well, she might not be the best test
make
case.
You. If you knew, if somebody told you, you know what, this got 98%, would you be more likely to go?
Probably not, because I have really lowbrow taste. Like, that's the other thing. Like, the movie that I want to see is not going to be... It's not going
to
be.
She wants to see Tulip Fever. We were actually thinking about doing Tulip Fever as a show, and I thought, well, we could have Jacques and Carolyn and somebody else on who they really enjoy how terrible this movie is. Well, I don't, Kate, you were talking, we were talking before we went on the air. Like, everybody, whatever the rating system is, and Rotten Tomatoes wasn't the beginning. I've lived with radio ratings. Writers live with box office sales and bestseller lists and stuff like that. It's inevitably the response is to game it somehow, as opposed to saying, you know what we're going to do? We're going to make really great movies. We're going to make sure everybody goes to see them. And the New York Times piece talks about how the studios, their response is, well, how can we figure out Rotten Tomatoes?
Yeah, you know, I think we need to figure out who their audience is. I think part of the dilemma that Hollywood filmmakers face is that, as Carolyn just pointed out, maybe millennials just aren't that interested, and maybe they should be gearing more movies to boomers and movie fans who really like going to the movies, like me. I love going to the movies.
Yeah, me too.
Because of the time I was when I first saw a foreign film and going with my mom and all of that. I love going to the movies. But going back to my point, I think Hollywood filmmakers face a dilemma. They're going for the big box office that's going to sell to all the 14-year-old boys worldwide.
Yeah.
But maybe they're not so interested in going, and maybe it's the boomers and the film fans that really want to see the movies, and they're two different audiences.
Yeah.
Two different
tastes. Well, that's true. I mean, and I'm a boomer. So, but I think going back to Rotten Tomatoes, you know, I think it's also maybe boomers would be less likely to think about to worry about Rotten Tomatoes. I'm not sure. That would be a sweeping generalization, but I think in a way, Rotten Tomatoes is connected to Look What You Made Me Do, in the sense that they're telling you if it's going to be worth your while or not,
mm-hmm.
you know, as opposed to some of us like me who might say, wow, it only got 63 audience rating, but how am I going to feel about it? Maybe I'll have a very different response. So I'd rather see what my response is. I'd be curious about my own. I guess I would have to have some reason to think it would be worth my while to see a movie, but once I did, I don't think the Rotten Tomatoes score would really change it, because I would want to compare my own reaction to that, as opposed to have somebody tell me what I'm supposed to think of it and then just leave it at that.
I thought it was interesting in the article where it said how that they think that maybe the Rotten Tomatoes, when it has a low rating, that people feel embarrassed about buying a ticket then, because they're like, oh, I'm an idiot if I see this movie that nobody liked.
But why would that make you an idiot? Why wouldn't that
I don't
make
know.
You an interesting, unique individual?
Exactly. But I think that there are a lot of people who get so concerned about what other people think that it clouds their own judgment.
Yeah. So,
Colin,
I think that's
do
true.
We know who the Rotten Tomatoes voters are?
Yes, we do. And this rather lengthy Times piece that ran yesterday gets into that a lot. And it's an interesting question. Before I say that, I just want to say that it's sort of like watching Dr. Rudolf Heimlich perform the Heimlich maneuver. You just watch Irene Papoulis execute what we on the nose call a Papoulian through line, which is she got from Taylor Swift's Look What You Made Me Do to Rotten Tomatoes. So, I mean, everybody on the nose does it. But when Heimlich does the Heimlich maneuver, it's a bigger deal somehow. So yeah. So one of the things that they said in this Times article is that there's a lot of reviewers who are from sites that you've never heard of, or sites that were maybe even invented to participate somehow or other in the world of Rotten Tomatoes, but also that the Rotten Tomatoes company, which takes this very seriously, and they're all cinephiles, and you know that they wanted to get critics are overwhelmingly male. The movie critics that everybody knows are overwhelmingly male. They're overwhelmingly white. They wanted to get more of those critics into the mix. But somehow the wide net that they cast for critics, and it's a really – I forget the number, but it's a really wide – there's a lot of people that Rotten Tomatoes considers a critic means that rather than hearing from maybe the three movie critics that you really like and trust, you're hearing from all kinds of people who – and a lot of whom have an incentive in order to maintain their position on the Rotten Tomatoes, you know, landscape or radar screen to give good reviews. Sometimes they're being squired to early screenings because they're known to give good reviews. I mean, once again, a lot of that kind of gaming. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. But what does it mean that, as I just learned, that Rotten Tomatoes is owned by Fandango?
Right, and which also – there's also some cross-ownership to NBC or some studio.
NBC, anyway, and Universal.
Yeah.
It means it's all corrupt, you know. And I hate the way they reduce – I mean, I love film reviews. You know, a good film review really gets into a lot of nuances. And what they try to do, no matter how many nuances it has, they reduce it to one sentence.
Right.
And one good or bad.
Not only that, not only that, but they reduce it to – and there's stuff about this in the article. The
rotten.
Flipping from a green splatter to a red tomato happens at 60, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're at 59, I mean, you know, the incentive to find some way to get to 60, even if you have to invent critics who don't exist or something. But I agree. We have to take a break here. But for me, the thrill of a movie review is often that it's well written, or it challenges something that I thought was true, and none of that. There's no room for any of that in the Rotten Tomatoes world. All right, we're going to talk about an actual movie when we come back.
Do you hear the critics sing? Sing about how they don't agree. It is a metaphor for life when mouths are big and speech is free. When the pundits all concur, you need to pinch yourself because you must be dreaming. If that happens, it never does.
We are back. We are doing the nose. With me to do the nose, and I guess with you to do the nose too, is Irene Papoulis, Kate Russian, and Carolyn Payne. We're going to talk about the movie Wind River right now. I'm going to try, without nose, to sum up Wind River. It is kind of a noir thriller, although it takes place amid a lot of snow and daylight for the most part. It takes place in Wyoming on a Native American reservation and the surrounding area. It takes place in the wilderness. It is essentially the story of two different men grieving the violent deaths of their daughters in different ways. It's also the story of one of those two men, a game warden played by Jeremy Renner, trying to solve the second murder, the murder of a young woman named Natalie. He is assisted in this by, first of all, the wonderful Graham Greene as this rather stolid Bureau of Indian Affairs police chief, and Elizabeth Olsen, who is an FBI agent, very much in the mold of Clarice Starling from Silence of the Lambs. With a little bit less ado than that, let's hear a little clip. This you're going to hear Jeremy Renner at the crime scene. He's investigating. He's looking. He's a tracker. His job is to hunt predators who are killing livestock. So he hunts wolves and mountain lions for the most part. He's come upon the scene of this murdered girl. He knows the girl. I think you hear him talking to Elizabeth Olsen. You probably hear her voice too, although she's, I think, mainly talking to me when she talks in movies. But so you'll hear him describe the scene as he sees it.
Over here, see this one? See how the toes turned out? The front is much deeper than the back. That's says she's running. Come here, I'll show you. She ran until she dropped here. See the pool of blood where her face hit the snow. Now it gets 20 below here at night. So if you fill your lungs up with that cold air when you're running, it could freeze them up. Your lungs fill up with blood. You start coughing it up. So wherever she came from, she ran all the way here. Her lungs burst here. She curled up in that tree line and drowned her own blood.
Well, how far do you think someone could run barefoot out here?
Oh, I don't know. How do you gauge someone's will to live, especially in these conditions? But I knew that girl. She's a fighter. So no matter how far you think she ran, I can guarantee you she ran further.
All right. So that's Jeremy Renner as Corey, this game warden. I'll just, before I get you guys started, I'll lay my cards on the table. I loved this movie. I consider it the best movie I've seen in 2017. I thought it had everything that I was looking for. If you are like Carolyn and you don't like to go to the movies and movie theaters, you make an exception for this one. It's not going to work very well or as well on a TV set. So much of it, this is the way in which the landscape, the environment, the milieu become, to use the old cliche, another character in the movie. But I have much more to say about it, but I don't want to blather on. Should we begin with the area where we don't agree, or should we talk first about what we all liked? All right, I'll make it. Okay, go ahead. No, yeah, you decide.
Well, we can talk about what we all liked. I mean, I can talk about what I like. Want to do that?
Yeah,
you guys? Okay. And so it's interesting because I feel like Jeremy Renner was talking to me too. I mean, you know, there's something, and hearing that voice just now again, I didn't know him from other movies. Apparently, he's like in a lot of famous movies that
I haven't
Locker.
Seen.
Oh yeah, that's right, The Hurt Locker, that was a lot. It somehow I didn't make the connection, but it's such a type, so for me, emotional truth is probably the first thing that I like and respond to in a movie, and I felt like the emotional truth, especially of his character, was so sort of rich and interesting. And there's something so attractive about him, that he's such a type of attractive man that's interesting, attractive in a certain way. You know, like the sort of laconic. He doesn't say a lot, but he's really thinking and
he's
really
like strong,
feeling.
He's like a silent type. I was getting
really
like
passionate.
A Gary Cooper.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the way he acted that role was so effective to sort of be that character. So and so his emotional truth is something I really, really liked.
Yeah, I thought that the soundtrack, the music, the cinematography, I thought all of that was very engaging. It was a very thoughtful movie, and I really appreciated that and liked it for that reason as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the cinematography, I was cold the whole time, like it, but not just in this, like you, it really, it set the stage for me. Now, I liked this movie, and I don't often like a lot of the things that I have to see here, but I
That didn't contain as much baggage as it sounded like it did.
Yeah. No, but I did really, I was excited when I saw the previews for this to see this, because I do like a good thriller. But what I thought that was so well done here for me was that it was those quiet moments, which sometimes for me in a thriller, like, break up the action and just don't, I'm not as engaged. The quiet moments in this movie I found to be more engaging than the, like, violent scenes, than the heightened scenes. Mm-hmm. I really did think that there was some interesting performances that I and it all was kind of set in this. I loved how it was filmed.
Yeah.
So let me make a couple of quick points, and then you guys can go to town on the Bechdel test stuff here, which I think is really interesting. And I think I'm so happy to be doing the show with three women, because you saw this very differently than I did. I did see this as really containing a lot of the elements of noir cinema. There's that sense of the power structure brushing up against a group of very marginalized people with less to lose. You see that a lot in noir. And you see this, you also see, and I'm not spoiling anything, I don't think, that ultimately the person who's trying to be a moral agent, whether it's, you know, Philip Marlowe as a private dick or an FBI agent or a game warden, they can maybe make some tiny improvements in one aspect of the moral decay that they confront, but they can't really change the equation. They can't change the dark architecture of the world that they're in. I thought it got some of that stuff really, really well. I will say it's directed by Taylor Sheridan, who has never directed a movie before. This is so sure-handed in a lot of ways. Although, was I the only person bothered by the very jittery handheld cameras in certain scenes?
I liked that. I thought that added something to it for me. It had that element of this realism. I dug that.
Okay, good. So see, that's a reason to go to the movies. He's best known as a screenwriter for Sicario, which has a very similar kind of empowered female FBI agent kind of person, played by Emily Blunt there. And the movie Hell or High Water, which is very similar to Wind River, and it has an interest in people left behind in whatever American progress has been made and possible ways that that can sort of build up into violence. Almost everybody in this movie, except for the Elizabeth Olsen character, has been left behind in one way or another. So other people have made the analogy to Clarice Starling in Silence of the Lambs. There's certainly a scene in this movie that is an homage to Silence of the Lambs. I won't say what it is, but I think everybody sitting here knows the scene I'm talking about. It's just absolutely that scene all over again. So, Kate, I want you to get us started here because you were the one who brought this up. It's a movie about women's tragedies and about the tragic ends of two women, but you feel as though it fails to be ultimately a woman's movie.
Well, it's about not just two women, but two Native American women who died very horrible deaths. It's a film about Wind River is a film about grief. It's a film about grief of fathers, and it's a film about relationships between men. And yet, I felt that the Native American women characters in the film were cardboard cutouts and virtually silent. And except for one scene between the mother of a girl and the FBI agent where she has to give her daughter's snowsuit. I know that's not what you call this, it's adults.
But it's the granddaughter's.
The granddaughter's snowsuit. And the woman, the mother, the grandmother is very strong and tough, and they're talking about this article of clothing, and she says, remember, it's not a gift. You need to give this back. So that was the one scene where there was a Native American woman speaking and speaking strongly for herself, and I think it just wouldn't have taken too many more minutes to change that dynamic. We have another mother, and she is in suicidal silence and grief-stricken over the death of her daughter, which, that all right, I can go with that. But then when we go back to her, she's basically a lump in the bed, and we don't even see her face, and she doesn't speak at all. And that's where I tipped over and had an issue with this film being ostensibly about the disappearance of Native American women, not really giving Native American characters, women characters, much room to speak.
Right. So for me, that was about halfway through the movie as well, is where I realized this is about, and I mean, they even say, I think that it's based on a true story, right? Mm-hmm. That it is. But I felt so, like, I felt that it really could have been told from a different perspective. For me, about halfway through, I was like, I wish that the Elizabeth Olsen character was more of the main character in this, or that it was told through a different perspective, like done with more flashbacks so that you had these female characters as more of telling something in the story. And that was, for me, what made the movie. I liked the movie. Like I said, I did like it, and I thought it was beautiful and very powerful. But for me, it would have gone from being like a good movie to being, I think I would have been really wowed by it had it been told with a more female perspective dealing with these issues.
And more of the Native perspective in
Absolutely.
General, because it's on a reservation. And but we don't, you know, it's sort of, you know, you could say it's like, you know, the white man that saves the day kind of. A, you know, plot and why, you know, the guy, you know, the his friend, the Native American guy, was a really interesting character that we didn't get to know as much as I would have liked to mm-hmm. also. But also back to the women, though, with the Elizabeth Olsen character, in a way we saw her through the male gaze, I would say. You know, we didn't learn very much about her in the way that we learned about him.
But which male gaze did we see her through?
Because we know which male gaze.
Collins.
Okay. So I have a little bit of a problem.
Yeah.
I'm seeing a therapist. But it seems to be the male gaze of the character played by Jeremy Renner is the male gaze of somebody looking on a surrogate for his daughter. He has lost two young women who are very, very important to him. The toughness, as you heard in that clip, of the second woman is also very, very important to him. You know, the fact that she was incredibly tough. And he's now looking at this other young woman who's pitted against the same landscape and wondering. And we hear a speech at the end where he basically answers that question. But he's wondering, is she going to be tough enough? But I don't see anybody except maybe creepy, weird subsidiary guys in this movie directing the typical male gaze at Elizabeth Olsen, and certainly not Jeremy Renner.
Not the typical male gaze, but the male gaze in the sense of we don't really, you know, it's sort of like, is she going to be tough or not?
Yeah.
That's the question. It's not what is going on with her. Where did she really come from? What was her emotional real reaction? What were her real emotions during the thing aside from I should be tough,
right?
You know,
and that's interesting too if you start to bring in Clarice, because Clarice's backstory was her vulnerability, right? Lecter in figuring out who she really was and wanting to know more about who she was frankly assaultive. That's his assault on her. The more that he can drag out of her, the more that he can deduce, the more he can play her, you know? And so you could make the argument anyway that knowing so little is known about Jane, the character played by Elizabeth Olsen, is it sort of allows her to be what she really is in this movie, which is kind of just an FBI agent being tested by a very unfamiliar situation.
Yeah. Right, a pretty one, you know. Yeah. So that's where the male gaze comes
she's
in.
And
yeah.
we don't get, except for that one scene with the granddaughter's snowsuit, we don't get any sense of the relationships between or among the women at all. We don't see the two grieving mothers connecting, and we don't really see the FBI agent connecting with the other women in the film either.
Right. And that's part of the Bechdel test problem, right? All right. We may have to stop there, but I would love it if everybody went to see this. Not everybody is going to do that just because I would love it, but... But like Carolyn went and didn't have a bad time.
No, it was not the worst.
I would never have gone to see it if I had just seen the little clip that's on TV. Never. When I say all the guns, forget it. But it's worth it. It's not just about guns.
Yeah, I think it's worth it. And just to put a point on it, it's not – for me, it's not that they're not – there's not enough about the women in the film. There's not enough about the whole community in the film. And the women are part of that community.
See, I feel very consciousness raised about this. We did this show about the Osage murders earlier, just a month or so ago, which really got me kind of thinking a lot more about Native American realities. And I actually thought in some ways there's a – I know I said we had to go to break, but there's a young man in this who's in the backseat of a police car who starts just talking about how he sees his options as a Native American. And I thought that was one of the more powerful.
Look what you made me do.
Yeah,
look that's where you know, and that's where I see the connection, right?
Double papillion.
Wow.
Papillion
the
through,
morality?
Like you're watching Yo-Yo Ma play the cello. Now, all right, we have to go to a break. We're going to come back with some recommendations.
Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants, with help from me, Kyone Wolf, and voiceover help from Sir Ray Hardman. The part of Bill Curry was played by Kanye West. On Monday's show, we'll be back with news from over the weekend on The Scramble. And now, back to Colin.
Okay, I have to say something about what we're doing next week, but just out of curiosity here on the panel, I'm sure you're all pretty excited, Irene Papoulis, Kate Rushen, and Carolyn Payne, to go to the movies probably this weekend and see It. Are you pretty excited about seeing It?
I actually do kind of want to see that.
I'm going to pass on It.
Yeah, how about you? It? You
want to see never it? Heard of it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Never heard of It.
Right. So Jonathan McNichol was absolutely convinced that this is the thing that everybody's going to be talking about next week is the reboot of the Stephen King It. I refuse to go see it. Rebecca Castellani refused to go see it.
I'm not going to go see it.
Yeah, you're not going to go see
it. I saw the trailer.
So what we're going to do instead is we're going to go to the re-release of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It's the 40th anniversary. There's a new remastered version. We're going to have a conversation about that. So if you want to join us, I mean, not at the movie theaters because we're not even going together, but that's what that'll be about. All right, time to make some recommendations. Irene Papoulis, what have you got?
Okay, I have a few things. First, Homecoming that Colin has endorsed before is a podcast that's a drama with Catherine Keener. It's so good. I listened to the whole thing. It's really good. I loved it. I also recently saw the movie Truth or Dare, speaking of a cultural icon, about Madonna, and it was really, really, it was so good. I had seen it before many years ago, but it was so interesting to think about Madonna and who she was in her culture versus now. She was such a great performer, and her sexuality was so different from what we see now, and it's really worth seeing again. And also the story by Miranda July in the New Yorker from September 4th called The Metal Bowl is a really interesting story about sort of Miranda July just kind of always surprises me with her writing because she says things she digs into sort of perceptions that we have about sexuality. And in this case, it's a long-term relationship that she's kind of digging into in a way that I think is really, really interesting. And you can see it, read it online. It's called The Metal Bowl.
All right. Read Miranda July in September. Kate, what have you got?
All right. I just happen to have read The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, a novel by Sherman Alexie, who is from the Spokane Reservation. And reading this book and seeing Wind River took me back to the film based on Sherman Alexie's screenplay called Smoke Signals,
oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
which was an early indie film with an Indian cast and crew.
I think Graham Greene may be in that one too. I'm not sure. But,
he probably is. And that's based on Sherman Alexie's book of short stories, The Lone Ranger and Tonto Fist Fight in Heaven. And then I checked out the poetryfoundation.org, and they have a Native American poetry and culture section with a whole list of Native American poets, including Lucy Tapahanso, who is the inaugural poet laureate of the Navajo Nation, and Linda Hogan, who's Chicksaw, and many, many other writers.
Hmm. All right. And Carolyn, what have you got?
All right. Well, I have kind of a silly little endorsement, but this week is my favorite news story to come out of this week and potentially in a while is just Google Jezebel girlfriend's poop. The Jezebel is one of the places that ran this story.
I was going to Google that anyway.
Yeah. Basically, there is an amazing, it is a true story. It happened to this poor girl. It'll make you feel like every bad date you've ever been on is okay. It will make you get a good life lesson about sometimes the thing that you try to do to make something better just will make it so much worse. And it'll give you a good laugh and give you something to talk about if you have nothing to talk about at dinner tonight.
The search terms once again are
just look for girlfriend poop.
Jezebel, we need that.
Yeah,
too.
Jezebel ran it.
I think
but
girlfriend
it was also
poop
in
could get a lot.
Girlfriend, do not do that.
Girlfriend poop could get
Google
a lot.
Google Jezebel girlfriend poop, and it should come up.
All right.
Sorry for whatever does come up that is not what we're talking about.
Right. Whatever does come up must go down. All right. So, first of all, I want to say something about Heather Brandon. Heather Brandon's last day is here at WNPR is today. Heather Brandon is responsible more than anyone else for the fabulous website that is WNPR.org. She really ushered this company into the digital age by building it. I'm heartbroken that she's leaving. Whenever I talk to people about why I'm here and why I feel so happy to be here compared to other places I've worked, I say one of the things I say is look at that website. That's a website of a company, of a digital company that's aware of where it is right now and how the marketplace is changing. So I will miss Heather. We will miss Heather. And I am sorry that she's leaving. When I go to a farewell thing for Heather today, I'm going to talk to Katie Tularsky about Mozart in the Jungle. I'm the world's latest person to this party, but I'm pretty sure she's the person who always talks about it. It's really good. I'm like amazed. This is a series that's on Amazon. It has Gabriel Garcia Bernal as some weird, twisted version of the real-life conductor Dudamel. It's a great series, and I'm hooked on it. I'm just on the first season. From this week, Jean Le Carré on Fresh Air. Listen to the this interview and listen to what Le Carre says about Donald Trump. It's the most interesting thing that anybody has said about Donald Trump that I can recall, like
wow.
ever. So dig that up. And then lastly, some of your favorite people from the Nose, like Susan Campbell and me and Frank Rizzo and Dan Haar's not really on the Nose. But we're all and a bunch of other journalists are going to be part of a benefit for a gentleman, Joel Bulger, who is fighting cancer. And some funds need to be raised for that fight. So we're doing a comedy thing called the Adorable Care Act. It's at the Mark Twain House this Wednesday night, the 13th, at 7 p.m. And we're going to do comedy with our friends from CT Improv. So each of us will get paired up with somebody from CT Improv. Also, Bob Englehart, Doobie McDowell, lots of people like that. So you could probably call the Mark Twain House for tickets. They're available somehow. And it's a great cause, too. So come out on Wednesday night and watch us make even bigger fools of ourselves. Thanks so much to Carolyn Payne, Kate Russian, and Irene Papoulis. There, I made it.